Thanks, Mark. Stephen Burke, and I'm the managing partner at ARS Investment Partners. We've been around for 50 years, and we run money the way you ran money in the 70s. You know, fundamental research, stock and bonds, not modern portfolio theory. We believe you buy businesses and own businesses for the long term, and we do that by, as Mark mentioned, we have a point of view on how the world, how we see the world and where capital is going to flow and who are the beneficiaries of that and who's going to get hurt. And that's really the underlying start for our process. And then we go and employ Graham and Dodd valuation analysis, though I'd say it's a modified Graham and Dodd, which Ben Graham would want you to do because, as he says, as the world changes, you have to adjust your process as well. So that's how we operate. And we run 8 or 9 different public market strategies and a long short hedge fund. Through year to date, 6 out of the 8 are outperforming the markets, a couple quite handily, and the 2 that are behind for good reason. They're less liquid, smaller cap strategies, which, as you know, have been taken out to the woodshed for a little bit. But we're very comfortable with where we are at the valuations. I was asked by Joseph Chen, because I do these every week presentations, do I ever go look at the scorecard and how right or wrong we've been? And I mentioned to him yesterday that I get a scorecard every morning. I see how our strategies are performing. But to give you a sense on our flagship, we've outperformed the market 16 out of 21 quarters running back to during this crisis. So it's been an interesting time. And if you think back for the last 5 years, there's been tremendous amount of change, wars and pandemics and the like. So it's been a really challenging time. I think when we look out going forward, my caution for people would be there's a million different ways our industry allows you to lose money. We create products at a tremendous rate, and every new product always has these views that the world's going to be different because of it. And I think we've gotten into a mode where the marketing's better than the management, and you really need to be much more selective about who you're working with and how you're working with and what you take for the best opportunities going forward, because there are some really interesting new things that are coming down the pike. But you always go back to the basics. Is this, you know, what am I investing in and why, and how's the valuations on it? Because, you know, there's a lot of promise on future stuff, but the timing between the promise and the realization is often a lot longer than people can afford. So I think one of the challenges for this environment is we now have, as Mark led off, the greatest uncertainty probably in our careers. And I started in the business in 1981. And there's been a lot of stuff along the way there, but this period is really the most unusual, in part because of the monetary policy conditions that have been put in place, where we've coming out of zero or negative interest rates and moving into a different climate. We've been, for the most part of the last 40 years, in a straight decline in bond yields, which really gave bond investors a great leg up, but also helped the equity investors too. And I think we're in a period where you're going to have to be much more discerning about where the opportunities are and how you play them. And I would just say that as we look at it, you should be in publics, you should be in privates, and you should look at the different alternatives, but you should manage it with a longer-term plan. I think the challenge for creating, building, and capital and preserving capital is to take a right time horizon and not be trading, unless you're an exceptional trader. I just don't think there are that many out there. So exceptional traders, no offense to all the great ones, but I spent a lot of time at Deutsche Bank, and they every new guy who came in to run asset management was allegedly the greatest trader on Wall Street. That never quite worked out the way they thought it would, but they got paid well during the storytelling. So I think we're in a world where you want to invest for the secular themes, you want to look going forward and not really focus on what happens when the war is going to end. Nobody knows. We don't really have good handles on what's coming at us in the near term, but you do have greater clarity on what are the opportunities and where does capital have to flow over the longer term. I think that's how we would focus on the environment today. So Mark, I'll stop there and pass it off.
That was great. I don't know how to follow up with that. But I really got scared, Stephen, when you started saying that you started in the 70s, and somehow the inflation of 70s flashed in my mind. I don't think we're necessarily getting there, but I wanted to start with that because it kind of speaks to the uncertainty and unease and anxiety that we all have. And I actually was thinking maybe it's not inappropriate to pause and think that at every given time that I've been at least watching the markets for the past 20, 30 years, we have always had uncertainties. We have always had exogenous factors that we couldn't really model. And we go through those. Sometimes we go through those with deep corrections. Sometimes we go through those fairly easily. So I would suggest that even now, yes, the rates are going up, and we have a whole generation of investors and traders who have never seen rates go up, who have never seen inflation there. But maybe we can manage that. Maybe this is something that we could gradually will go into. Yes, there is a war out there, and that probably is the most important external effect that can impact the macro environment, and we haven't probably seen the full impact of it. But we have also had wars, and we were able to manage that as well. I come from actually Wall Street background, so this is a very heterogeneous group, as you can see, three white guys from Wall Street backgrounds here. But I started venture about 10, 15 years ago when I left Wall Street in 2007. And at that time, I was one of the few people who would actually take institutional investors to see private companies in Silicon Valley, and they really loved it because they were really creating the future of it. I remember some of my investors who first saw Facebook and MySpace, they were really impressed, and those companies were tiny at that time. And I would gather some focus groups of young people, I call them teen focus groups, and we would talk to them and say, how are you spending your time? And that was kind of pointing towards these new social media sites. So from that stage on, I was really seeing the connection with the private companies, and I was being drawn to it. And when I finished what I was doing in Wall Street, I thought I should actually leverage the insights I've learned and the connections. And I had made a lot of money for my clients, so I thought maybe I should just try to do some of it as a principal investor. What I'm getting at with that is that at that time, public and privates were almost completely two separate asset classes. Over the past, I would say, 10, 15 years, they have merged quite a bit. Now, some of that was useful, but some of that has created some volatility and some bubble. Because private investments, venture capital, is a fairly small industry. You can't pump too much money in it and get everything done. And that's something that the large companies, large funds didn't understand. SoftBank came in and thought that, well, we'll choose three companies, among them we'll pick the one we like, and then we'll give them several hundred million dollars and they can buy their way into a growth. And for a while it happened, then it crashed with WeWorks, and then we started going down. And I think we're going through that cleansing phase where the larger funds are realizing that maybe this is not the right sandbox for us to play in. Maybe we should stick with other asset classes, because this is a very risky environment. You can't apply the same valuation metrics that you do in private markets to the public ones. We are doing due diligence on an early stage startup, actually in a content space directed towards Southeast Asians who are in the US, very good content. And we're trying to see a subscription base. Would it make sense for us to invest or not? And the founder is a brilliant super achiever. She's asking for a pretty high valuation. And with the help of her fiance, she's put together a valuation table comparing herself to other public companies. And the valuation in that case is kind of in the middle. The problem is that she has less than $1 million of revenue this year, and this is all banking on getting $3 million next year and $10 million the year after. So my point is that this is something that I learned early on when I got into private markets, that you can't use the same valuation metrics. You have to really have judgments, and you have to have the capacity to take lots of risks. This is different from what happens in the public markets. So I think overall, as an asset class, again, echoing what you said, this is a time to do longer term investments, which would be talking to my own book, but I think venture capital, especially early stage, falls into that, not late stage, that you want to look into sectors that are going to be benefiting from the next 5-10 year horizon and the trends that are happening, logistics, defense, healthcare, environment, renewable energy. These are the areas that we know for sure are going to grow. Will crypto grow? I don't know. But I think I'm pretty sure on these areas it's going to grow. So I better put some money into the companies that are doing well in those areas and are building long-term trends. So I'm going to stop there and pass it on to you.
Thank you. I think, you know, if you take a step back and you listen to what's certainly been said by the first two speakers, a theme that I'm going to continue is emerging, which is, you know, carefully understanding, I think, to a greater degree than we needed to, you know, in the near future, what the purpose of any individual investment was. One of the things, so, you know, that was alluded to is, you know, I'm in the process of trying to launch a new manager focused on fixed income in what is historically the worst environment for fixed income investing since we had data on this. So, you know, we couldn't have timed that better. And, you know, for our own strategies, what we began looking at was, okay, well, that's not going to stop us. We can't, you know, the time of, you know, when we decided to do this, and it's true of anybody who has money that needs to be put to work, right? It's sometimes not even an option. That's outside of our control. So we then went and looked at all the different factors that were in our control to build investment theses around those. And, you know, what we settled on specifically for fixed income was actually going back to the original purpose that any fixed income instrument came into existence, you know, God knows how many years ago, right? So, you know, invest to hold, hold to maturity, you know, define the period of time that you're comfortable being in this investment as it relates to the current environment. Right, so for us, you know, we always liked to be a shorter duration investor just to try to avoid some of that uncertainty, but we've started to bring that in a little bit, right? We think we're going to be in a period of extreme, you know, uncertainty for, you know, probably 6 to 18 months at least. So that's the investment horizon that we're comfortable with then. What are the opportunities that then, you know, we think are out there? To Stephen's point, we don't want to trade right now. It's so hard to try to, you know, time the market. Maybe we'll have to. But rather than doing that, then finding something that we're very comfortable with that we can hold, you know, until its maturity without being worried that we're sacrificing income. If that as a thesis is an acceptable total return proposition for the holding period, you know, that's something that's worth buying. And then within that, we began to find investments that were, you know, in the public markets, you know, suitable for long onlys, both in equity and debt instruments, that took on these kinds of characteristics that would actually making them total return propositions, at least year to date. And we think that those attractive characteristics are going to remain attractive and accretive to portfolios over this period of volatility. Certain features that came into play then, you know, limited exposure to rates, such that, you know, material changes in how people were responding to what they think the Fed was going to do would have minimal impact on the portfolio, and producing a lot of, you know, decent cash income up front to help to bring that discount impact forward, and then give you lots of opportunities to reinvest. And we began seeing themes in the broader marketplace that were consistent in terms of producing opportunity. So, you know, that's the approach that we're taking, just understanding at the outset with a greater degree of certainty than we needed to previously what the purpose of the investment was, how many factors would, you know, leave it exposed to drawdown during this time period, and whether or not we were comfortable with the risks that that entailed.
Mike Hugh. Okay, so I was just thinking, because I'm going to tee you up to this, how the landscape's changed. To what extent, we talked today, we had a really interesting session about, you know, the new reality, like the new normal, right? Inflation, 3%, 4%, it's a new factor. Interest rates, they may come back down fast, we're not sure. Uneven growth, or pockets, some of the secular trends. And how are you best positioned? Now, without talking your book, actually, you can't talk about public equities, you can't talk about venture, and you can't talk about private credit. But what do you think is the best strategy other than your strategies? And it could be a geography, you know, part of the world, or parts of the world, or otherwise, you get the gist. So maybe back to you, Stephen. Where would you be investing outside of the ARS?
Well, I'm a part of the Queen City Angels. I'm a member there, so.
Other than your book, no,
that's one spot. I also chair a private company that's AI in the travel business, corporate travel business. So I do invest around. I think you want to spread out your risks and realize that there are different speeds for different investments, and you really need to layer those speeds against your liquidity and future cash flow needs. And I think that's one of the ways I would play it. But I also think the key in this environment is secular themes are going to be where capital is going to flow to, and you want to own the beneficiaries of that, regardless of the format that you're investing in, whether it's public, privates, or venture. And you want to think about it that way. And you also want to really be careful about expecting too high a return in a low growth environment. We're going to have to grind out returns, I think, going forward. Not that there won't be some big winners, but you know, we've gone through a lot of stuff in the last year. Look at meme stocks, SPACs, and the other stuff we put out there. And we, you know, as I said, there's a lot of ways we can convince people to invest and lose money. I think it's a time to be really careful about how you're putting capital to work and not try and be too speculative about any of the things you're investing in, regardless of the format.
I would look at strong and established public companies whose valuations have come down and who are platforms or are becoming platforms. I mean, the platforms are all recognized, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and others. But there are others like Shopify that was extremely expensive and you could never really justify owning it. Now you can get gradually to a point where you could do that. In the chip space, I think it would be really wise to buy maybe a basket of the chip companies. We don't know what will happen in there, not just Taiwan Semi or Nvidia or ARM, but all a basket of it. And I would do that comfortably because Wall Street is heavily short-term focused, if I may say so. When I was an analyst and I would go to our clients, and it wasn't just the hedge funds, even the most conservative mutual funds like Fidelity would be focused on what's going to happen the next quarter. And that's actually one of the disconnects between the VC world and them, because we have to take the long-term view. So right now, if you talk to many hedge fund managers who even are positive on the trends, they'll say, yeah, well, Google is great, it's cheap right now, but they're not immune to macro. People are going to pull back on their ads, and Google will see a revenue decline. That's probably true. But we don't know if it will happen or not, and it's not the reason not to invest right now. So I would look at large established names with reasonable valuation. I will look at China, because it has come down quite a bit, and in the longer term, that market is going to be still a huge opportunity. They have already innovated in many areas. When I was going to China in the early 2000s, they would ask me in there, what is happening in the US? Which companies are doing well so we can duplicate that model? Literally, I mean, they were asking, just give me the models and we'll do that here. Now they're actually innovating. They have the largest electric car market, and they are really strong in AI. So I think that market, given its potential as its own customer base as well as its technology, is huge. I would look at that as well.
So for me, I go back to this concept of investment thesis, which is a little bit market agnostic, right? So, you know, thinking of something purely from the equity markets, right? Not what I would, you know, normally do. What's the time horizon that I need to hold the investment? What is the purpose that it's meant to serve? And what are going to be the sources of return? Is it price return? Is it price return over 6 months? That's going to be very hard to find in you know, most publicly traded equity markets right now. Not impossible, but you know, very, very hard to find. If you have to find it, then try to figure out where you're going to go to look at it, like go to look for it. But maybe it's something different. If it's a 3-year holding period that you're looking at, try to find an investment then that you're comfortable with holding for those 3 years, and understand then what are going to be the draws on your free cash during that time period, and can you afford it? If you need to lever, is 3 years the right holding period? If you don't need to lever, then maybe it's perfectly fine. Is it going to be a source of liquidity for you, or would you need to break that glass and draw upon it? In which case, you can't go to private markets, and you have to remain in public markets. And just being able to pair each of these concepts for the purposes that investments serve more closely to, you know, why we're entering them, I think allows in an environment like this to, you know, limit the number of moving parts that you're exposed to, and in so doing, you know, control the risks and your own, and match them back to your own risk tolerance. And then what I've always found emerges from that is, you know, at least a better understanding of what to expect from an investment, and a better ability then to match it to, you know, your own appetite for risk and whatever purpose it's trying to serve. It kind of breaks away from needing to be anchored to one particular market or another.
That whole focus on purpose assumes there's a strategy, and some of the family offices don't even have an investment policy statement. So, but it's good points taken. Any questions? We want to, we're going to talk about the asset management industry, how it's changing and could change, and then move on to disruptors, because everybody, the disruptor should win in every market, and then impact philanthropy. Any questions for these gentlemen? You got it all figured out? No, what's JP Morgan's view of all this? It's like, oh my God, he's calling me to talk about JP Morgan's view on all this.
Well, I mean, I'll speak for everything that was said was like, we agree with from a standpoint, things that we like are, we call them megatrends. So from a long-term investing standpoint, the themes of sustainability, healthcare, technology, I mean, it all goes, it's some of it is connected when you talk about chips, like where these chips are gonna be incorporated in everything tech, if you believe in anything, everything is tech related, right? There's so much growth in tech. Tech is in everything that we use, from our phones to be able to open our garage doors, to turn our lights on. So as that growth continues to happen, and tech that's happening in innovation and healthcare is going to be a continued growth area. Sustainability, again, at JP Morgan Chase, I always say this, we put solar panels in our parking lot at our corporate center here in Columbus. Those solar panels are meant to generate 80% of the power of that building, which has 11,000 employees and 2.2 million square feet. So, like, sustainability is going to continue to be a big growth. On the other side of the spectrum, when you talk about time horizon, right, somebody that has a shorter term time horizon in the fixed income market, yes, like the fixed income market where it is today, but I think a lot of that's priced in, and a midterm muni portfolio where you can now generate a yield of 4% after tax for those income seekers are a good place to be as well. So, you know, there's a lot of growth. You've also seen, we've answered questions from a lot of clients, because late last week, our CEO, Jamie Dimon, made a statement about something about a hurricane. So an economic hurricane, and what does that mean? Does that mean we got to batten down the hatches and go to cash? Like, there's still a lot of uncertainties in the short term, but from a long-term sustainable standpoint, like, we're still like positive on the market.
Mark, if I just said, because that was, that headline got massive amount of attention, but what was missed was his next line, which was, it may be smaller, it may be really bad. And I think that's one of the things that I would caution everyone to dig a little deeper on the research. Don't just go with the headlines, because that's where people really get thrown off. And what he said was not as bad as the headline, and that's what sells news media. But I think you really have to be careful about going down another level in this environment and doing a little bit more research than people have had to do in a zero interest rate environment. I'd say a lot more research than you had to do in a zero interest rate environment. So I'd leave it at that.
Thank you. Just, you know, one thing Mark mentioned, you know, for not all investors have an investment policy statement or like a concept of, okay, I'm going to distribute my portfolio across so many different assets, and this is why. I actually think, you know, if you haven't thought about that, this is the environment to do it, right? You get so much from that, and from going through, you know, some of the more traditional risk management tools that sometimes can get overlooked, like authorized instruments. What am I comfortable trading? What am I not comfortable trading? Why? You know, limits. How much risk do I want to take from each of these different risk factors? What is the purpose that this serves in the portfolio? You know, and articulating all of this, you know, now it's always a value added proposition. But I think when you're looking at a period of heightened uncertainty like this, what you'll learn about your own portfolio and your own comfort level on a go forward basis for how you want to be invested will pay incredible dividends right now.
Sure. I hear a lot of talk about cryptocurrencies in the future, but what I want to ask you all is, are we currently in an era where businesses and enterprises should be investing in cryptocurrency or creating a coin that could fund their businesses today? Are we in that era right now, or is that still off into the future?
I don't think I'm qualified to answer that, but that never stops me, so.
I don't know if I'm qualified, but we certainly looked a lot at it, and I guess I can tell you what we use and what we don't use. So if you look at this investment thesis concept from within the cryptocurrency space, that is a little bit left lacking still from my experience, even with something like as fundamental as Bitcoin. Obviously, part of the investment landscape, period, full stop. But again, what purpose is a Bitcoin investment serving in the portfolio and over what time horizon? There are uses there, but sometimes they're not articulated. I think that there's an attractiveness to price momentum that crypto has generated, but then there's this second order question of how long should I be in this investment? What is the long-term attractiveness that sometimes in the crypto, you know, landscape doesn't get put forward? What we are looking at actually is use of the blockchain technology itself as a distribution mechanism, right? So then not necessarily anchoring ourselves to a particular coin and a concept associated with a particular coin, but trying to come up with a way to see if we can benefit from the use of a new technology as more of a dedicated mission statement. And there we found interesting applications that we're exploring.
So yeah, I don't really have anything to add. I think that was well said. You need to ask, why do you want to create a coin? Does it really make your product or service as a business more accessible to people, make it more liquid? Or is it because you can actually make a lot of money right now by coins because they're popular? I don't know the answer to that. There are only few cases that I've seen where utility tokens as well as blockchain applications really made sense. What I mean by that is that they made something that wasn't possible before possible. And it wasn't just me selling my coins to him so he can sell it to you and then backwards so I can make some money in the arbitrage. So to me, that area is still undecided on. Kind of going back to your earlier question, Mark, and tying to what you're saying about, because this is new technology, right? We're all enamored by the new technology. This is the future. I would suggest if we want to look into the investment areas, we actually have a good case study of what to invest in if you look in the past 3 years. We have had tremendous crises, and let's see how were we able to deal with crises and what industries helped us. So first, we had COVID. Of course, if it wasn't for the healthcare industry and the vaccines that was developed in record time, this would be a different world. So that's an easy one. Second, we had people who couldn't work from home from their work. So of course we had Zoom and others that enabled it, and that played out well. But then we have other issues that technology hasn't been able to solve. Everybody that I've talked to here is complaining about shortage of workers. Well, where is our big technology? Where is AI? Where is blockchain to solve that? Where is technology to solve the supply chain? They can't do that. So I come from technology land, and I totally believe in it, but what I'm trying to get to you is that actually some of the trends in the next 10, 20 years will not be technology in its core, will be other areas that are aided by technology. In a way, technology isn't everywhere. The statement that Andreessen made, software, it's everything, has already happened. If you look at our portfolio, You might not think that we are a tech investor. We have companies that actually help students get to universities, help them find mentors, help people find their therapists, but all of them use technology as a core because otherwise it wouldn't work. So I don't think it's a technology that will save us go through this crisis and these volatilities, but look at what industries need to be innovated. Obviously, supply chain, healthcare, education, re-education, all of these areas are, I think, areas for investment. So I hope I didn't digress too much.
No. It's all on point. We're always trying to crunch it all in, right?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make a shout out to our Asset 9 survey. It's our ninth. You can, on, it's 361firm.com/asset9. You can see the eighth survey and the results on a no-name basis, and we welcome you to weigh in. I think the more and more our community does this, we help each other. If you look at the number eight, you'll see how we were thinking about the war and the implications coming out of that. Some we got right, some we got wrong, but we're, you know, just sharing information, and it's a useful dialogue. This is going to talk about Fed and, you know, changes in your portfolio. And yeah, if you don't have an investment policy statement, this would be the time to have that. Come join our 361 firm community of investors and thought leaders. We have a lot of events created by the community as we collaborate on investments and philanthropic interests. Join us.